until the break of day. Was in a wee midnight hour, long till the break of day. Oh, when those blues creep upon you and carry your mind away. I lay in my bed, but I could not go to sleep. Yes, I lay in my bed, but I could not go to sleep. Oh, with my heart in sorrow, and my mind was sank in day. Was that's when I get to thinking of days of long ago. I get to thinking of days of long ago. And that sweet girl I used to love, I don't say no more. Why do you stay so long? I'm singing blues, why do you worry me? Why do you stay so long? Oh, you come to me late last night, kept me up till way past dawn. People, lately I've been so worried, and I've been so confused. Yeah, lately I've been so worried, and I've been so confused. I guess that's the reason why got those midnight hour blues.
David Bromberg, what can you tell us about that song that you just played? It sounded like a combination of two old blues tunes to me.
Oh, it's Wee Midnight Hour. I think that's the guitar part is a little bit of Mississippi blues here.
Right. Yeah. Who are those versions from?
Well, Wee Midnight Hour is a Leroy Carr tune, and Mississippi Blues is Willie Brown. But the reason I put them together, I mean, it's not a tune that I do a whole lot, but the reason I put them together is because the Mississippi Blues thing sounds like a piano part, and that one part reminds me of Leroy Carr's piano, so that's the way it came out this time.
Mm-hmm. Many musicians tell me about one initial inspiration they can point to. Many of the musicians I've talked to say, yeah, it's either a specific record or a specific person that they heard at a young age, which made them go, wow, music, and that made them start. Did you have an experience like that in your life?
I had bunches of them, lots of them. I think first time I heard B.B. King, and I got a record, a Yves Panisset record called Guide to Jazz. Yves Panisset was this French jazz critic, and I think he was a communist, and which is a different thing in France than it is here. And he selected some of the tunes, or his viewpoints were tinged by an ideology. And in order to show some of the roots of jazz, he looked around to find something, and he got this Sleepy John Estes cut called Working Man's Blues, which is very difficult to decipher and understand what he's talking about. I mean, it's, you know, Sleepy John Estes took diction lessons from a turtle, I think, or something. I mean, he's just really hard to understand. I mean, you understand the words, he's not complaining at all, but I'm sure Panisset didn't understand that. Working Man's Blues, it has to be the downtrodden Negro complaining about his lot. It isn't, but it's a great track. I mean, it's really neat. So that was a big one for, you know, acoustic blues for me. And, I'm trying to think of first rock and roll record that hit me. I don't know, it was just always there. Whatever was on the radio, a lot of it hit me. My Baby Loves the Western Movies.
Mm-hmm. Was a lot of the blues and ethnic music available to you where you grew up? You grew up around New York City.
Yeah, I grew up in Westchester County. Well, I got turned on to the blues through that record, and I started looking through more, and a friend of mine, father had a huge collection of one of the largest in the country of blues records, 78s, and I used to go over there and tape them over and over and over. So, I didn't live far from New York City, and I could go into the city and collect other things there.
Were you part of the Washington Square scene at all?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit.
Who are some of the first live players that influenced you, that you, maybe your peers or your contemporaries who started to have some influence?
Well, I used to play a lot with my friend David Nickturn, who wrote Midnight at the Oasis that Maria Muldaur recorded. And I learned a lot from a musician named Jody Stecker, who's just turned me on to all kinds of different music. And, I don't know who else. Lots of people.
Mm-hmm. You're known somewhat as a multi-instrumentalist, although your main instrument is guitar. Is there something about the guitar that attracts you more than those instruments? Was it your first instrument?
Well, yeah, it was my first. My first was actually flute, but I gave that up after a while. And a little bit of piano, but I can't play piano to save my soul. But a guitar, and it's the one I worked on most. I practiced most on it, played it longest of the instruments I still play.
There was an interview I read with you once in which you talk about playing both blues and bluegrass influenced music, and you said that you could hang out with all the great blues players because they thought you were a great bluegrass player, and you could hang out with all the bluegrass players because they thought you were a great bluegrass
player. That's right. And the jazz players thought I was loved the ragtime, and the ragtime players liked the jazz chords, you know. Sure, I'd learn from everybody. That's the thing. It was great always hanging out with people who could play something better than I could. Most musicians are happy to teach you.
How did it come that you became sort of the sideman of the late 60s, early 70s around New York, playing with Jerry Jeff Walker and other people, appearing on a lot of different records?
I don't know. I like it. I was happy about it. I loved accompanying people, and I just really got into it. I think my approach to guitar was a little more unique back then because I played rock and roll for a lot of people on some electric guitar, and I was using electric guitar techniques on the acoustic guitar. And at that time, nobody was using a vibrato on the acoustic guitar or playing much above the third fret. So I guess, you know, that I got my own kind of tone, my own kind of melodic approach, and people had no better taste. So there I was.
And you didn't mind being in the background?
Love it. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a couple shows with Tom Rush where I'm backing him up. And it's just somebody whose music you enjoy, it's a real pleasure. It feels good to be an accompanist. I got really into the head of being an accompanist. I never thought I'd want to do anything else.
Are there certain people that you prefer to accompany? There are certain ones that you really get a kick out of?
Sure.
Specific people?
Yeah, well, I like working with Tom Rush. I always enjoyed playing with Paul Siebel. At times, playing with Jeff Walker was just wonderful. There are just lots of people. Phoebe Snow, I had fun playing with her. Dylan, of course, was a big kick.
What was that like? Because I know that he likes the one-take approach to recording.
Well, it was great for me. I like that, too. And you know, it's a spark, and he makes things happen.
Then if you enjoyed being a sideman so much, what made you, I guess about 11 years ago, 12 years ago, go into being David Bromberg out front, leading the band?
Well, I started writing songs myself. It wasn't that I said, I'm going to write songs. You know, I was sitting around playing guitar, and out came a song. And I was playing with a very fine guitar player from New Jersey named Steve Berg. And Steve liked what I was doing. He wanted to accompany me, which I found very flattering. So he played bass. He put down his guitar and played bass for me. And we'd do concerts at, you know, folklore societies and things like that. And meanwhile, we both would, you know, he played with rock and roll bands, and I'd do rock and roll sessions and, you know, anything to make enough money to pay the rent. And, you know, just I started getting more calls to do gigs by myself, and it just went that way.
Your first album was recorded partially here in Philadelphia at the old World Control Studios.
That's right, in Germantown.
And I think that Philadelphia is a really strong town for you. You've always been a big hit at the folk festivals. You draw very well in concerts. Why do you think that is? Has it been because you performed here a lot in the beginning, or?
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. Yeah, I performed here and got a good response.
And you keep coming back here. It seems like the popularity never wanes. It's always been strong for you.
Ah, I hope so. I like playing Philadelphia. I like the city very much. I was born here.
Getting back to your career, I think that there's a real difference between your earlier records, not necessarily all of the ones on Columbia, but the beginning records done for Columbia, and it starts to change towards your end of your stint on that label and emerges full-blown on the first Fantasy stuff and continues through that. You were talking about performing and how, as a solo, it was kind of accidental. It just happened that you got into doing it more and more. And it seems like at a point in there, you had decided, well, I'm a performer and it's me out front, and I'm going to do some things to make it more of an act or try to go. And I don't use the word negatively commercial. I know that your singing style changed somewhat in there.
See, that's interesting. I never would have, and not because I take commercial to be negative, but commercial was really pretty far from my mind at all times. Not that I wouldn't welcome, you know, being commercial, but I was always allowed to do what I pleased. And I liked that. So that's just what I did. Three things happened to make the records change. One thing that happened was that my singing improved a great deal. I got to singing better. Another thing that happened is that I learned how to make records better. And, you know, as you do it, I mean, that's an art. It's different from live performing. And another thing that happened is that the performances grew from situations where it was just me and Steve and any other musician who happened to be in the area to people that we'd played with, and things started to set a little bit, not in a negative way, but I started working with people who could anticipate what I was doing and I could anticipate what they were doing, and things became more complex, and I felt as a result more beautiful. I mean, there was just much more, and all of a sudden I learned how to lead a band. And I think that's the third thing. You know, it was mostly my learning. I learned how to sing better. I learned how to lead a band. And I learned how to make records better. So I think that was it.
You seem to attract really the cream of all the different players that were around, both from a folk acoustic world and from more of the old style jazz, and they all seem to flock to your bands. How is it to have, I mean, I feel that they're very high caliber groups.
Thank you. I always thought so too. I don't know, just lucky. Well, one thing, I learned how to lead a band, and I learned how to compose it. You know, I had some people playing with me that, where it didn't work, and I learned how to fire people. You got to do it. And but one thing that I discovered was that virtuosity only takes you so far. You need a certain level of proficiency, and beyond that, personal relationships are more important, how everybody works together. I mean, it's like a basketball team, you know. A whole mess of superstars won't beat a bunch of guys who are good and know each other, how to work with each other. And that's, you know, same thing with a band. You make better music when you're more concerned with the intensity of or magic that happens when everybody is together than with a bunch of people just laying their trip all over everybody else.
Did you have specific ideas about what you wanted with groups, or did it gradually just evolve? Because there's all different types of influences. There's, you know, the influence of acoustic bluegrass fiddle sounds and mandolin, and somewhere along the line the horns come in, and so you have fiddles and horns together, and there's some of the records sound very New Orleans-esque, as the later stuff particularly. There are certain tracks that are very New Orleans. There are certain tracks that are very electric blues.
Mm-hmm.
But most of it just combines it all. Mm-hmm. Did you really have a master plan in the beginning?
No master plan. As I said, I started out playing rock and roll. I played guitar for a short period with Chubby Checker. I played on a lot of the old Jay and the Americans records, you know, so I was doing that. But I had never conceived of putting together a band at all. I started getting booked to play at some folk things because I was supposed to be a good guitar player, and I'd sing a little bit. And so then I started playing with Steve, and then Andy Statman started playing with us, and he played mandolin, and then we got Kenny Kosek played fiddle, and we worked out triple mandolin things and triple fiddle things, and Statman also played saxophone. Well, there was something that went back to the rock and roll things that I'd done. So what the heck, you know? So we did some tunes with Andy playing saxophone and Kenny playing horn parts behind him, you know. So we got a really unusual blend. And then when Kenny and Roger Mason and Andy Statman formed their own band, I had to have a saxophone and a fiddle player. So... and also somewhere in there I ran into Peter Eklund, who played beautiful Dixieland trumpet. And I'd heard a lot of records, you know, well, you know, the classic blues with Bessie Smith. It's somewhere between Dixieland and blues, and I liked some of those tunes. It was great to have him on them. And then he got into writing rock and roll horn arrangements. I mean, everything just, you know, I kind of functioned as an editor. I'd encourage people to learn certain things, like... I can't play much penny whistle, but none of the people who played penny whistle with me played it before they started, you know. But the horn players, I mean, it was pretty easy for them to pick up. I mean, if I could play a tune on it, then they could. And I'd steer people different ways, but as much as doing that, I just let them go. And rehearsals were always more, my function was more editorial. I'd usually play a tune, people would do stuff that I hadn't dreamed of that was... fine, I said, that's great, but we're missing something here. We need like a pad. And they'd come up with something, no, that's wrong, and so on. And I'd be like editor. Occasionally, but pretty rarely, I'd know exactly what I wanted, every note I wanted on something. And I'd, you know, write it out or just play it over and over until I got it. But most things came a lot more organically. Forgive the hippie phrase.
Let's have you play another song. This one, what's this one going to be?
What is this one going to be? Early This Morning? Thank you. was early this morning. My baby made me song. Early this morning, my baby made me song. She said, I'm leaving you, daddy. I don't need you anymore. I said, tell me, pretty mama, girl, where did you sleep last night? Tell me, pretty mama, where did you sleep last night? And she said, that none of your business, huh? Daddy, if I do you right. I said, I love you, pretty mama. Yes, yes, that ain't no lie. I love you, pretty mama. Girl, that ain't no lie. Yeah, the day that you quit me, mama, be the day you die. Just because you think I'm sleeping, girl, don't you think I'm drunk? Oh, when you see me sleeping, girl, don't you think I'm drunk? Hey, I got one eye on my pistol, and the other on your trunk.
Okay, that was Early This Morning. David Bromberg is my guest. Let's just take the period from when the band disbanded up to the present and discuss that for a few minutes. What prompted your decision to disband the group and leave performing for a while?
Well, to really explain it, we'd need a bottle and a little more time than we have. A whole lot of things happened at once. There are positive things and negative things involved. I think the positive are more important. I became fascinated with violin repair and violins. And I began to begrudge the time that I spent hanging out in airports when I could be at my workshop doing work. And the career was doing very well. And then George Kindler was killed in a motorcycle accident. He played fiddle with us for quite a few years. And Dick Fiji didn't want to face the road anymore. And I had some of those feelings, too. And my management was becoming very disorganized. My record company completely collapsed. And I used to feel that I was invulnerable. And I got too sick to stand and for the first time had to cancel gigs because of illness. I mean, I just couldn't stand because I'd done gigs with 104 fever. I'd passed out on stage, but always managed to do a show, but if you can't stand up, you can't play. And just a lot of different things like that were going on. I wasn't happy where I was living. I was living in Marin County, and people don't play music together in Marin County. So whole lots of things. But I really got interested in the violin, and when I started playing music for a living, I did it because I thought, well, if I don't try it, I'll always be reproaching myself with the thought, well, I might have been able to do it if I'd tried. And then I jumped off the deep end. I decided if I fall on my face, it's my face, and I'm just going to get into it and do it. And it was a huge step. And getting into violin making was the same kind of thing. So if I want to do it, why not do it? It's my life, and I've only got the one. So that's why.
Besides the violin making, what else is in your future? Are you going to make some more records?
I'm going to make a record this summer. I owe Fantasy one more record, so it'll probably be very hard to find. And after that, I'll probably make another with I don't know what to say. I don't want to get slanderous, but with another record company, I'll sign a contract with somebody else and make another one. But I don't know exactly how much performing and how much violin making I'm going to do. I do spend the most of my time thinking about violins. I mean, I'm in school 5 days a week and on the road only 4 days a month.